Defunding the police. It's gone from a phrase on a protest sign to a real discussion as cities finalize their budgets. More on today's Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Hispanic communities have been especially hit hard by the coronavirus, but why? We'll dig in. Plus, a contact tracing technology experiment of sorts in a perhaps unlikely venue, the GOP convention, what it might mean for the general population. And one of the darlings of Sundance this year was a documentary about a bunch of Texas boys. We'll have the story. That plus more on schools and COVID-19 today on The Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time for this Thursday, August 13th. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Texas set a new record yesterday in the very worst kind of way. Deaths linked to the coronavirus. State data shows 324 people died of the virus Wednesday, the highest number in Texas on a single day. This comes as both the number of new cases and the number of new hospitalizations has been on the decline in Texas. But the positivity rate, that's the percentage of coronavirus tests that come back positive, has been on the rise. The bottom line? Texas cases aren't spiking in numbers right now as they were a few months ago, but it would be foolhardy to let guards down. People are testing positive at very high rates. The latest is that nearly one in four tests are positive. And then there's the number of deaths, now over 9,000 in Texas. I'll let that sit with you for a moment. Now on to another story that's captured the attention of the country, rethinking police funding in the wake of new examples of police violence. There are discussions happening in all of Texas's biggest cities as new budgets are drawn up, but proposed budgets in Dallas and Fort Worth do not include cuts. Houston actually increased police funding, and San Antonio is considering the same. Now the same debates are happening in Austin, but it looks like the outcome could be different. Audrey McGlinchey reports on City Hall for our home station KUT in Austin. Audrey, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Laura.
How much and what kind of cuts are currently being proposed to the Austin police budget?
So the city council here in Austin is currently proposing immediate cuts around $20 million. Mm-hmm. There's some other proposals they're thinking about, essentially totaling a cut of $150 million. But basically what they're doing is they're putting some things aside that they would discuss throughout the year. So as I said, immediately the cuts they're looking at are about $20 million.
So that $20 million looks like that's about 5% of the police budget. Who's spearheading these efforts and what are they saying? Why are they saying that these cuts need to happen?
Yeah, so, you know, we've heard a lot from racial justice groups in Austin who have been really asking for cuts like this for years now. And it seems we're really in sort of we have a lot of political will and momentum right now with a lot of the civil unrest and the protests that we're seeing mm-hmm. across the country. So politicians are really, you know, more keen to make these kinds of cuts. And a lot of the push is coming from several council members here in Austin, but really all of them seem on board for at least some sort of reduction in the police budget. The thing that we'll be seeing more of once the city council here in Austin takes this vote and then begins discussing potentially more cuts throughout the year is that, you know, racial justice groups in Austin have asked for much bigger cuts than what we will be seeing immediately now. They've asked, you know, that we either cut the police budget by a fourth, even a half. Mm-hmm. And the cuts that the city council here in Austin is discussing now aren't going to get us there. And so even though I think, you know, we heard 4 hours of testimony yesterday. Some people said, you know, thank you so much for doing this and for listening to us. Others said, thanks, but this is not enough. And you know what we've been asking for, and it's much more than this.
So tell me what exactly is on the table, because it's one thing to remove money from a budget, but it's like, well, okay, well, what does that translate
to? Right. What is that? Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest cuts, about a half of that $20 million that I mentioned, would be coming from canceling the upcoming 3 cadet classes. Mm-hmm. So folks might know what I'm talking about is basically training new police officers. So the city of Austin hosts about 2 or 3 of those training classes every year. And so the city council is considering, and looks like they will be canceling the 3 cadet classes for the coming fiscal year. And that would save the city about $10 million. Now the police chief here, Police Chief Brian Manley, has said he has a lot of concerns about this. He says he sees this as the greatest threat to our public safety. And his reasoning is that if we don't train new officers, we'll have fewer officers. Mm-hmm. And he has said it would get us to staffing levels of 2012, when Austin was a much smaller city. And so he worries if the police force doesn't keep up with the population, that we could see rising crime. There's some debate about it, you know, if there's actually evidence and studies out there to suggest that that's what we would see. But that is his concern, and that is his argument against it.
And he's said, I think, that the police department is already understaffed. This would mean no mm-hmm. new officers coming in, further strain on the department?
Right. They've been understaffed for years. You know, we do have one of, if not the highest paid police officers in the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. Yet they've had trouble recruiting folks for years now.
Well, and I guess, like you said, it's a question of, well, what are the numbers? How do we decide what understaffed means?
Exactly. Yeah. So from their perspective, it's understaffed. But I think some activists and a lot of folks who interact with police and have had negative experiences would say, well, I think less policing is actually a safer option for me.
So who else besides the department itself is arguing against large cuts, and what are they saying?
You know, actually, I've sat through, at this point, hours and hours of testimony to the city council. One day they had 10 hours of testimony just hearing from people about what they wanted to see with the police budget. And in that 10 hours and hundreds of people, there were maybe a handful of people who said they didn't want to see significant cuts to the police budget. And so we're really seeing the evidence for what, you know, activists and people who are out there protesting have been saying, is that for some reason, this moment is different than others, that we really do have a mass of people who are being vocal and are putting pressure on their local government to make these changes that they want to see.
So it sounds like, yes, that it's likely the city council will approve some of these cuts. Do we know how soon?
Yeah, likely today. They were poised to take a vote last night, Wednesday night, but they, you know, were going a little late, decided to kind of pause for a minute. So likely we'll have a vote today.
We've been speaking with Audrey McGlinchey. She's a City Hall reporter for our home station KUT in Austin. Audrey, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
COVID-19 has hit Hispanic families across Texas particularly hard. In the Houston area, Hispanics account for the highest number of cases in Harris County, and they make up an outsized share of coronavirus deaths, both in Houston and statewide. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall has more on what's driving the spread of COVID-19 among Hispanic communities.
In North Houston, Edmond Diaz sits in the driver's side of his car and tilts his head back as a young man in white protective gear and blue gloves sticks a long cotton swab inside his nose. Diaz is there with his son and his wife to get tested for COVID-19. He's taking every precaution since he says the virus nearly killed him. Just a few months ago, Diaz was afraid to go to free testing sites like this.
Aquí en la esquina de mi casa estaban haciendo exámenes de la pandemia.
Diaz says even though the site was close to his house, he didn't go because he worried if he tested positive, he would be detained by officials on the spot.
Esa era mi ignorancia y mi miedo.
That was my ignorance, my fear, he told me. Diaz is from Mexico and thinks he got sick at his construction job in June. A coworker had a bad cough. Nobody was wearing masks back then, he says. When Diaz got sick, he tried to keep working at first. Then he was so weak he had to stop. In early July, he says he could barely breathe. It happened to be the first anniversary of his father's death.
Y pensando, bueno, hace un año entierro a mi padre. ¿Será que este año me van a enterrar a mí?
A year ago, they buried my father, Diaz says. Is this the year they'll bury me? Like Diaz, tens of thousands of Latinos in the region have gotten sick from the virus, and they're dying at higher rates than other groups. Though Latinos make up 40% of the statewide population, they account for 52% of the confirmed COVID-19 deaths in Texas, according to Department of State Health Services data.
Hispanics tend to have higher rates of diabetes, you know.
Elizabeth Perez is with Harris County Public Health.
With COVID, it was new, and so we started to see it happen in front of our eyes.
She says one of the driving reasons behind the numbers, a lot of Latinos work essential jobs.
So grocery stores, waste management, cleaning, sanitation, food delivery. So there's an increased risk to them.
She says another big factor, no health insurance. Nearly 30% of Hispanics in Texas don't have health insurance, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation.
We had someone reach out to us on social media because they were undocumented, and the mother was having difficulties breathing, and they were scared because they were uninsured to go to a hospital because they couldn't afford it.
Perez also says rumors about the virus spread on social media, and she's seen undocumented communities avoid testing for fear they'll be detained. Hispanics are also more likely to live in multi-generational households where COVID-19 can spread within families. Deanna Greer is medical director of the San Jose Clinic.
A lot of the patients I see were concerned because they have either their grandmother, their mother, their father there, and they're elderly, but they're the one who had to go out and work.
Greer's clinic serves uninsured patients in the Houston area. Many are Latino immigrants.
It was difficult for them to make that decision that they're going to need to go out even early on, you know, where everybody kind of stayed home. But they themselves really had to go out.
In North Houston, Herman Diaz eventually recovered from COVID-19. But before he did, his wife and two of his kids got sick, too. His family is fine, but he's lost friends to COVID-19. He hopes other Latino families realize how serious the disease is and protect themselves. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar has been watching what Texans are talking about. Hey, Wells.
Hi, Laura. Comments from the president catching fire on social media, with Donald Trump saying clearly on Fox why he won't fund the Postal Service. Quote, they need that money in order to make the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots, he said, adding, but if they don't get those two items in funding, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting. His remarks just prompting a welter of comments. Deanna Sears-Lamone via Facebook says she's worried that her mail-in ballot will get lost or not counted, but with a bad knee, she can't stand in line for hours. The new head of the post office is creating chaos for a reason. She adds that she's sad that many will not vote, adding that she'll be bringing a chair with her on election day. And Lynn Watson Guy says these efforts by the current administration to undermine and underfund the USPS are reprehensible. As stated by the president of the Postal Workers Union, this entity is a service, not a business. A couple of the comments we're seeing there, Laura. I'll be back with more later in the program.
Well, I bet there are a lot of folks out there who have something to say about this. We are watching for those comments on social media, or you can email them texasstandard@kut.org. Business and your money on The Standard. I'm Laura Rice. First, it was toilet paper, then hand sanitizer. Now, the latest pandemic staple in short supply is Dr. Pepper. Alejandra Martinez from KERA North Texas explains.
It was born in a Waco drugstore more than a century ago. A pharmacist named it after the father of a girl he once loved.
When you think in terms of Texas and soda, Dr. Pepper is one of those things that typically is going to come to mind.
And Michelle Belanger has been drinking this stuff since she was a kid. She says lately it's been a challenge to find the fizzy dark drink at stores in Houston.
I don't know if it's Corona related, but I know that my local store where I tended to get it, they've still got the little inventory tag in the space where it should be, but very rarely are they getting it in.
Vicky Drahn is the vice president of corporate communications for Keurig Dr. Pepper, which is based in Plano.
Texans love and appreciate their Dr. Pepper, so they could see why that might be happening. With everything going on with the global pandemic, I think they're wanting to treat themselves, and a great treat is a cold Dr. Pepper.
Drahn says Texans shouldn't worry. There will be plenty of Dr. Pepper to go around, and maybe bubble up some memories. I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas. She's a pepper, if you drink Dr.
Pepper, you're a pepper too. Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. A busted tourism industry, a flailing oil and gas sector, and shuttered bars have led to a multi-billion dollar revenue shortfall for the state of Texas and for many local governments. But statewide, sales tax revenue actually increased last month compared to the same time in 2019. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports on one hill country city that's been able to weather the pandemic because of higher than expected tax revenues.
Local governments generate revenue in many different ways: court fees, emergency services, municipal bonds, but above all, taxes. For areas with big tourism industries, the pandemic has thrown a wrench into a key revenue-generating engine.
Hangar Hotel, please hold.
The Hangar Hotel in Fredericksburg is a World War II aviation-themed hotel. Visitors hear World War II era classics like Glenn Miller's In the Mood while they're on hold and when they walk into the lobby. But nowadays, fewer and fewer people are in the mood to stay in hotels.
I mean, usually almost every weekend we're full.
Kelly Griddle is the marketing manager for the hotel. So in normal, pre-pandemic times, the Hangar Hotel is completely booked up.
The last couple weekends, we've probably been a little less than half full.
That's a big drop-off, and this is a boutique hotel right next to the runway of the Gillespie County Airport. Well-to-do tourists park their prop planes and jets a few dozen yards away from the hotel's entrance. How long is the current lag in business sustainable?
I don't know. there's so many pieces and parts that work into that. I don't know.
The hotel is about to reopen its diner, which might help. But the drop-off in occupancy has been tough, and it has ripple effects.
Every year we do a street paving program. We cut that program in half this summer. We cut our sidewalk funding in half. In the parks area, we cut out a new restroom that we had planned to purchase for one of our parks. And again, we have some positions in both those departments that we're not filling. So primarily in the area of streets and parks.
Kent Myers is the city manager. He works right off of Main Street, a tourism hub. The city's hotel occupancy tax revenue from April through June of 2020 was about 13% lower than the same time span in 2019.
But a lot of our short-term rentals are actually doing very well. So the sense we have is people are wanting to maintain that social distancing by getting into short-term rentals versus hotel establishments.
And that boom in short-term rentals led to a bump in hotel tax revenue in July. After that three-month drop-off, the city actually saw an increase of about 6% for the month of July in 2020 compared to 2019. And sales tax revenue is even stronger.
So far, so good. Our actual sales tax collected so far this fiscal year is almost exactly what it was last year. So we didn't experience any growth, but it's been pretty flat. So we've been very pleased so far.
And an important note, sales tax figures lag 2 months. So the massive hit the city took in April wasn't known until June. The surprising recovery in May, an increase of $30,000 over the same time in 2019, wasn't clear until July. The state will send June figures to cities later this month, but it already said that for July, statewide, sales tax revenue jumped about 4.3% compared to last year. A big part of that sales tax revenue, online business. Fisher & Wisser Specialty Foods in Fredericksburg has seen a huge jump in website sales, largely by design.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been in the online business since 1996. We've had Jelly.com and been producing and selling our products online for many, many, many years.
Case Fisher is president and CEO. The company has been online for more than two decades, but the website, it wasn't great. It needed a redesign.
Yes, when people had stopped coming up, there was really no other choice except to invest more in our website, which we had already been doing, but we were kind of pushed into it to really start diving into it.
And it worked. Online orders took off this year, from about 220 per month in the first quarter to about 440 per month in the second. And because of origin-based sales tax, when a customer in Dallas or even out of state buys, let's say, an $18 bottle of Gewürztraminer wine, a dollar and some change goes to the state of Texas, about 10 cents goes to Gillespie County, and of course, the wine goes to the customer, post haste via UPS. But even with all this good news, Fredericksburg is projecting a budget shortfall of about $500,000 for its general fund. At the state level, the outlook is more grim.
Overall, we will see a reduction in what is available for the legislature to spend from a $3 billion surplus when they left last session to right now about a $4.6 billion shortfall.
Glenn Hagar is the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts. He oversees tax collections and tells the state legislature how much money it has to work with. And that's important because the state constitution forbids Texas from spending at a deficit, with very few exceptions. The state must at least break even. And that $4.6 billion shortfall, it's a somewhat optimistic projection.
The current revenue estimate assumes that the economies are going to continue to open up, that government restrictions will not be put on businesses, that actually they will slowly ease up as we continue through the fall.
But during a webinar with the Journal of the American Medical Association, CDC Director Robert Redfield said the fall and winter might be, quote, one of the most difficult times that we experienced in American public health. But there is some reason for hope, at least on the fiscal side. Texas has a rainy day fund. Hagar says the Texas Economic Stabilization Fund will have about $8.7 billion in it when the 2021 legislative session starts. And, Hagar says, increased federal funding could help with the shortfall. Fredericksburg has been able to close the gap in large part due to sales tax revenue from tourism and online business. They won't have to lay off city employees for now, but many other cities around the state aren't so lucky. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in the Texas Hill Country.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A contempt hearing to determine whether Texas is failing to make court-mandated changes to long-term foster care has been postponed. It was supposed to take place Friday, but will now be held in September. Attorney Paul Yetter represents the young people who filed the class action lawsuit in 2011, leading a federal judge to deem the system unconstitutionally dangerous to children. Yetter says the state is not complying with a number of provisions in the court order.
What we've asked the judge is to give the state a limited amount of time, 1 month, 30 days, to either come up with a plan that they will fix these problems or they will be penalized. And it's up to the court to decide, but we've asked for substantial monetary penalties so that something finally is changed.
The Texas Attorney General's office has argued the state should not be held in contempt of court because it is making improvements to long-term foster care. A North Texas soccer player is criticizing fans who booed members of FC Dallas and Nashville SC last night for kneeling during the national anthem to show support for racial justice and Black Lives Matter movement. It was the first match both Major League Soccer teams played before fans since the outbreak of COVID-19 halted the regular season in March. Following the game, Dallas defender Reggie Cannon told the Dallas Morning News it was frustrating to not receive support from their own fans.
I even knew when we decided to kneel, I knew it was going to happen. I had a feeling that should tell you guys something, that I knew it was going to have some negative pushback. from having a unified response over what's going on.
Cannon said players had asked that the anthem not be played, but they were planning to kneel regardless. The share of Texans who own their homes rather than rent them has increased since the pandemic began. Texas A&M University's Real Estate Center reports home ownership rose nearly 4 points from April to June to 67.5%. Economist Jim Gaines says over the same time, apartment occupancy rates declined by several points.
Normally, home ownership rates don't move numerically as quickly as they have here in the last 6 months, and particularly last 3 months, on the quarterly home ownership rate here in Texas. That was a little bit of a surprise.
Gaines says home ownership jumped by 6 percentage points in Austin during the second quarter, more than any other major metro area in Texas. And the U.S. Labor Department reports today initial jobless claims in Texas fell for a fifth week in a row, with about 51,000 workers seeking benefits last week. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice. When Republicans gather in a couple of weeks for their national convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, attendees will be required to wear face masks, and they'll be tracked around the convention hall by a system that notes who they've been in contact with. It's a contact tracing tool that GOP officials say can help reduce the risk of a COVID-19 outbreak. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to tell us about how contact tracing technology is, somewhat belatedly it seems, coming to bear in the fight against the coronavirus. Hey there, Omar.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
So how is the contact tracing system at the Republican National Convention intended to work?
Well, the ones that we've been hearing about, like the Apple Google thing and some other ones that we've talked about before have relied on phones. This one will be on the badge that they are wearing. Mm. So it will use, you know, kind of the same, you know, Bluetooth technology, but it will be in the form of the badge that they wear. So, I mean, presumably they could take it off, you know, they could put it, you know, on the dresser or whatever. Mm. But it is intended for the same purpose, to be able to see who has come in contact with who in case there is an outbreak. So it is a bit of irony that the GOP would be the ones kind of maybe pioneering this technology, because we really haven't seen it deployed in conventions or in any mass scale yet.
Well, that's a good question for those maybe concerned about privacy. Who is going to monitor the information collected?
This will go straight to health officials if there is an outbreak, and the RNC has made it very clear that this is not going to be, you know, information they're going to give out to the public. This is not information that's going to be shareable. You know, they're not going to be able to track people and then share that. It's going to be only if there's an outbreak, and to notify someone if they were exposed to coronavirus.
I see. So they're going to try to be narrow about this, but I'm sure there are people who still have concerns. You know, information can get, you know, in the wrong hands. Have you heard a ton of that, or not so much?
There have been some movements, especially as this contact tracing technology has been kind of tested and deployed in other countries. There have been a lot of privacy concerns. In this case, it's sort of the RNC taking it upon itself to say, you know, we're scaling this down. We are taking precautions. We're going to test people before and during the convention. So they actually put a health expert kind of in charge of all this, which is, you know, a big change of tune from what we've heard about some of these gatherings before. So that I think is a pretty significant change and a step in taking this much more seriously.
You mentioned the Apple Google thing. More specifically, that's a contact tracing initiative that they've been working on. And as you mentioned, we have been talking about this on the show. It's been slow to be adopted by state governments, but there have recently been some changes, I understand.
It has been. Initially, it was that Apple and Google worked together on this API, which is sort of a framework for people to develop apps for contact tracing. And it was to be country by country. Each country would have one app that would use this technology. In the U.S., it's state by state. So we have all these different states kind of looking at this and deciding, yeah, we're going to do this, or no, we're not going to do that. And it has been very, very slow, particularly in Texas, we've talked about. Virginia this week, though, is planning to release an app, which would be the first one in the U.S., called COVIDwise. And then we're also hearing that Alabama has a closed pilot on it. And there's about, I think, 20 states that are moving on this to some degree. But yeah, I mean, we're into August and we're still not seeing these apps out there. So it has been very, very slow progress on digital contact tracing.
So should people expect, though, that Virginia taking this step is a sign that more states are to follow, or do you think it's still wait and see?
I think what's going to happen is we're going to see other states looking to see whether it's successful, whether it has an impact. The problem with contact tracing apps is that it relies on people downloading them. And if you don't have people downloading them and using them, then they're really ineffective. So you really have to get a big number of people to even participate. And it is opt out. I mean, you can delete it. You don't have to use it. So it is getting kind of this volunteer aspect moving and motivated to use it. Otherwise, there's just no use for it. So I think that's going to be the big challenge, is just getting people on board, and then other states seeing, well, did people download it? Did they use it? Was it effective before they commit the resources to developing these apps?
Well, and as you just brought up, that's the sort of the other side of this equation, is it's people participating, but then also that data has to go to someone who needs to be able to analyze it and then take the next step. And so that sounds like what Virginia has committed to, at least.
It is, but Apple and Google have put a lot of restrictions on who would get that data and how it would be used. I mean, it would be very, very limited. And in general, the way the API works is it's really just to let the people who have been exposed know. It's not to create hotspots or mapping or do any kind of other work with the data. It's really just to let people know, you have been exposed. You need to take these steps, and then kind of being able to create that network of digital contact tracing, and not in place of traditional contact tracing. This is in addition to that.
Well, we will be watching, as will Omar Gayaga. He traces all things tech over at techminutetexas.com. Omar, thanks again.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
An expected Trump administration move today would nix an Environmental Protection Agency rule limiting methane emissions. The Associated Press reports the EPA administrator will sign a rollback of the Obama-era rule that required companies to inspect and fix equipment to limit pollution from the oil and gas industry. Environmentalists and some oil majors oppose the rollback.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Every summer since 1940, hundreds of incoming high school seniors gather in Austin for Boys State. That is just about every summer. This summer, it was a virtual gathering, as I'm sure you guessed, but the intention was the same: bring together boys from all over Texas to create their own state government from the ground up. It's like a political camp on steroids.
Primary polls are now open.
Get yourselves ready for a turbulent election.
Whatever happens to you, best of luck.
You win, I support you fully.
My name is Steven Garza, and I'm running for governor.
Filmmakers Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain captured this in a film now coming to Apple TV+. Boys State won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at Sundance. Director Jesse Moss joins us now. Jesse, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, Laura. Thank you.
And Steven Garza is one of the featured attendees in the film. Steven, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Steven, I'd like to start with you real quick. You went to Boys State originally to get the experience, not to make a movie. When did you first hear about Boys State, the event, and why did you want to go?
Yeah, so 2 years previous of my going to Texas Boys State 2018, one of my best friends, Elijah, had gone to the program through our JROTC program at my high school. And then, my other best friend, Sebastian, went the following year, and me being involved in politics, it was right up my alley. So I was always asking my instructor about when, the application or the nomination process would open up. And, he knew that I had to go to that program.
Jesse, you did go to Boys State to make a movie. Why in Texas? These happen all over the country.
Yeah, well, I knew only vaguely about the program. I didn't, like Stephen, have the benefit of going through it as a young man, and neither did Amanda. She didn't go to Girl State here in California, mm-hmm. where we grew up. It was actually after we read about the Texas Boys State program in the Washington Post in 2017 that it struck us that it was a really unusual environment and that it was bringing together kids of very different politics to engage with each other and build a government from the ground up. And we loved the idea that it would be a prism into our current political moment and an opportunity to see how young people were really thinking about their role in politics and governance and learning about democracy.
So, Stephen, back to you. Was the experience of Boys State, the actual event, what you expected, or did it surprise you in any way?
Oh, every single day was a surprise, and I didn't expect for it to become as emotional for me as it did, and as insane as it was. And yeah, the film that a lot of the craziness and the rowdiness of the event. You know, I was going in there thinking more kind of Model UN, but it's you know, which I've never participated in, but it is really pretty off the rails. At least the year I went was.
Mm. Jesse, what about from a filmmaker perspective? Was Boys State in Texas in 2018 what you expected?
You know, we weren't sure what to expect. That was one of the challenges, is it was a little hard to get a complete picture of what was actually going to happen that week. We had read that the Boys in Texas in 2017 had voted to secede from the Union, and that was a really provocative political gesture, and that did get our attention. So we knew there was a little bit of rowdiness. They were really feeling these cross currents of national politics and expressing them in their own ways. So we expected some of the craziness that Stephen's talking about, which we certainly encountered and you've seen the film. What we didn't expect, and we did find as well, was something much more elevated, a real commitment to discourse, to working together to compromise. The Lord of the Flies aspect of it was what we saw initially, but the boys kind of settled down to a degree, and that's where it got really interesting and where Stephen emerged for us as a really remarkable young man to be traveling through this experience with him.
Absolutely. And that's what I was going to bring up. It's always amazing when documentaries have these characters that you know are real people, but who have such compelling dramas that are part of real life. So what's it like starting with 1,000 boys and trying to find those stories to highlight?
You know, that was one of our great challenges, was to winnow the cast down to a handful that we could follow. That was the idea for the film, was really to share their experience and to find boys who were very different, who came from different parts of Texas, who had different politics and different backgrounds. So that was a long process, actually much longer than the process of actually shooting the film. We spent 3 months traveling all over the state, meeting boys who'd been selected, getting to know them. And we actually really accidentally met Stephen at an orientation of boys in Katy, Texas, in the Houston area. And he just kind of, you know, Stephen's, when you first meet him, he's pretty understated, but he really spoke to us, and his kind of old soul quality, his sophistication about politics, his intelligence. We weren't sure how well he'd do, and honestly, we thought probably not so well, because he's more progressive and a lot of the boys are more conservative. But that was some of the excitement that you allude to in unscripted filmmaking, is you just don't know what will happen.
So Stephen, for you, what did it feel like to be made into a bit of a character?
It's very surreal, and I know that there's a film coming out to the public, and it still doesn't feel real. You know, again, it's just completely count my lucky stars that I was at the right place at the right time, and that my reservedness for some whatever reason caught Jesse's attention, and you know, got him to, you know, ask more about me and get to know me, and ultimately decided to cast me in this film, and just trying to be true to myself and knowing that I would be immortalized in this project, and that I didn't want to look back on it with any regrets.
So from your experience at Boys State, and then from watching the film, what do you hope people can learn, Stephen?
That it's still possible to talk to each other. You know, the political climate in the country right now is so tumultuous and contentious and toxic. And because of that, you start getting attached to labels more than policies. And instead of seeing other people as humans, you see them as the opposition or the enemy. I think that the film shows that if a bunch of 17-year-olds can get together as rowdy and as, you know, as they are, but they can still sit down and come to the table and talk to each other with civility and respect and walk away compromising. So I hope that that's the message that people walk away after watching this film.
Jesse, as a filmmaker, were you aiming for anything on top of that?
We were so thrilled to see that unexpected outcome, to see Stephen really display an extraordinary ability to summon these rowdy young men to their better angels was one of the great surprises of the story. Stephen is a remarkable orator and a great political leader, and to see him emerge amidst this unlikely crowd was very thrilling. You know, we laughed a lot making the film. We cried too on the journey. It was so much more than we ever expected. And the young men who share the stage with Stephen are all like him, really ambitious, smart, complicated, interesting. They all make very different choices. Sometimes they make the wrong choices, but it's great to see them all really rise to the occasion. Sometimes sink to the occasion, I will say. But Stephen is really our hero in the film, and it was a lovely experience to share it with him.
Jesse Moss co-directed the new film Boys State. It won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at Sundance and will be available on Apple TV Plus starting Friday. Jesse, thank you again.
Thank you, Laura.
And Stephen Garza is one of the people you'll meet in the film. Stephen, thanks to you.
Thanks so much.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Some Texas schools are back to in-person classes, and as more prepare to reopen, questions remain over whether state leaders will report or even explicitly collect data on COVID-19 cases in its public schools. Corbett Smith writes, doing so would give a glimpse on how safely Texas and its school systems are managing the return to campus. Smith is an education reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He joins us now. Corbett, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What have Texas and the Texas Education Agency said about tracking COVID-19 in schools?
Well, at this point, and we are at least a week into some schools around the state actually having classes, they're still considering the option. When I reached out to them almost 2 weeks ago, they at first didn't have a response, and a week later said, well, we're investigating that. Check with the Texas Department of State Health Services to see whether or not they're tracking it. I reached out to that department, and they themselves also said that they were considering the options, but no one definitively has decided to take up that at this point. And you know, you're starting to see in the Metroplex, we've had several school districts open for in-person instruction. You've got places all across the state doing so here in the next couple of weeks. So as we are entering this really uncertain time for schools in the COVID-19 pandemic, you've got a lot of questions as to whether or not people will get a full and accurate measure as to whether we're doing it safely.
Well, not only has school begun, but there's already been cases linked to teachers, to students. Is that right?
That's correct. In the Metroplex, there's been several cases, but these cases have been semi-related to school functions, be it cheerleading camps or teacher in-service days. So we haven't seen at this point in the Dallas-Fort Worth area any cases of something in the fall semester. I reported last week of an incident in Plano ISD where a summer school session for students with disabilities was that they sent out letters to parents informing them that their child might have been infected and might have had contact with somebody who had COVID-19, a positive lab confirmed case. So I don't think it's a matter of if, it's going to happen. It's just going to be up to, at this point, either county leaders or district officials to figure out how to share that data.
So you report there's already a process for schools to report highly infectious disease cases. How's that working?
Well, I mean, the State Department of Health Services requires that any type of, infectious case, and then, that could, involve any number of different types of illnesses, mm-hmm. that they're required to notify the state when these kind of conditions come through. But it's not up to the state to then, collect those reports and then produce, any type of report. They have not committed to that, nor have they committed to disaggregating that data and telling people how many, cases are in a given county or in a given school district involving schools.
So I guess there's at least two levels of questioning of how this might get processed and who's going to take charge in making that change in the process. So as you said, this data is out there, but I guess the first question is, how it's flagged for local health authorities and then how that flagging continues up to the state. And then who's going to be responsible for the aggregating and the breakdown? And that's, am I right that that's where the questions just remain?
Yeah, in both of those instances. And, local school districts are also kind of being put on the spot right now because they typically don't like to share specific data information. They don't like to say we've had X number of cases at this campus,
right?
Because they normally side with privacy laws, federal privacy laws regarding health and student confidentiality. So they're being asked, by parents and by the community, hey, we want to have a better understanding of the number of cases and how things are going in our community.
We've been speaking with Corbett Smith. He's an education reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Corbett, thank you again.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And of course, that sound means it's time once again to check in with social media editor Wells Dunbar.
Hi, Laura. Good to be with you today. Obviously, this discussion about schools and how COVID-19 is going to impact, that's still hot on the minds of many people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can hear. I think you hear my children caterwauling in the background because they're not in school yet. But it's nothing to joke about, obviously. Lots of people chiming in about this report. Nearly 100,000 children tested positive with COVID-19 over the past course of the past couple months, I believe. Mm-hmm. That's what one of our commenters, Carrie Prejoda, is noting. She says this isn't from schools reopening, but since the data is from July, most schools haven't reopened yet. This is probably from camps and family members, she notes. She says that it's only going to get worse now that schools are opening, though. And Joe Puskas says it's almost as if closing schools and keeping kids home was helping. They're an implicit call to keep that going forward. Obviously, depending on the district and the city, place by place, county by county, we're seeing a lot of different forms of school and what that's going to take here in the fall semester. So obviously one that, especially for parents, I think is basically the only thing you can really think about going forward.
Yeah.
Heck of a story.
It is, yeah. And we talked to the former Secretary of Education earlier this week. I asked her, why do we have to do this again? And she had a lot of compelling reasons. We had that round table of, special education professionals, and they talked about their specific challenges, and everyone is doing their best. But, the Secretary of Education, the former one, admitted, it's not without risk. So it's concerning.
Yeah, so everyone having to balance those their tolerance for risk out there. Continuing to hear about that story we mentioned at the top of the show, President Trump's comments about essentially intentionally withholding funds from the United States Postal Service to prevent mail-in ballots from reaching their intended target. Craig Andrews York via Facebook says he's concerned about the state of the Postal Service and notes he has a number of friends who do mail order business. They're all reporting slower deliveries. And again, he is more alarmed at these reports of people getting their medications late, lost in the mail, things like that. So obviously a story that is continuing to resonate with people. A slightly different story that's really resonating with folks is all this talk about Dr. Pepper. I mean, 2020 just keeps on hitting. Seriously.
Right.
Now we have a Dr. Pepper shortage. It's kind of shocking. So hearing from folks about that. And, Laura, I got really wistful for some of those pre-pandemic times, thinking back to that KUT, our home station in Austin, our holiday Christmas party there, where I don't think it's bragging to say I was the hit of the party with my Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
Get your heated Dr. Pepper, throw a couple lemon wedges in there. So good. Obviously, might be a little hard to find the good stuff right now, but if you can. Well, and it's pretty hot outside still. More of a winter thing.
There.
But, but yeah, Dr. Pepper, what? Texas favorite beverage.
All right. Thank you so much, Wells Dunbar. Thanks for listening.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.